Welcome to Stranger Still,
a podcast where we answer the questions you never thought to ask.
I'm Nick Wood.
I'm John Beacon.
And this week, as part of our ongoing month of the Flying Machine Patreon special, We're just having guest after guest helping us out. And this week, from the Potster podcast, we have Jay. Everybody, welcome Jay.
Hi, guys. Glad to be here.
How's it going?
Good, and you?
I'm doing great. You know, this is a topic that you actually brought to us a while ago, and now's the perfect opportunity to talk about it, and that is code switching.
Yes. Yeah, I thought it would be a really interesting topic just because it's something that is sort of in my background, being a Black American from Detroit. Mm-hmm. And like just the fact that a lot of times I might speak differently with my family or my friends, especially my friends back home, as opposed to, say, people at work or even some of my friends that are of different cultures here. And it's something that I wasn't used to until my husband, who happens to be white, pointed it out to me one day.
Yeah, like, I didn't even know this was a thing, but it happens every day. I have a podcast voice that I put on.
Are you talking the phone different?
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that I forgot to say, though, before we go too much further is, speaking of podcast voice, you have your own podcast. I mentioned it's the Potster podcast. Can you tell our audience a little bit about it?
Yes. So Potster podcast is where politics, religion, and history collide. Mm-hmm. So I talk about the stuff that's not polite to talk about around a dinner table. So politics and religion. Now, the way I kind of came along in terms of doing this was that I earned my PhD in political science back in 2012. And while I was in grad school, I taught college courses. But then since earning my degree, I left academia. I now work in the private sector, nothing political. And so podcasting has helped me stay updated on current events, and really it's kind of my baby. Like, it's my outlet for all things political.
Yeah. And one of the things I love about the podcast is that you do talk about some very uncomfortable subjects, which I think our audience might enjoy. Like, you've talked about reproductive rights and a lot about evangelical hypocrisy, that kind of stuff. Those were pretty recent. Maybe squeamish topics that are handled in a very nice way.
Yeah.
Very professional and immaculately produced. So I would encourage our people to go check it out.
And not polite dinner conversation.
Exactly.
But I would argue that history also isn't. You ever try to bring up Abraham Lincoln's meatball recipe at a dinner with your family? Doesn't go well.
No.
Yeah.
So code switching. I think that this is kind of the perfect Venn diagram of where our two podcasts meet, because it's kind of a weird science thing that our brains just kind of do. It's been around for a really long time. It has to do with language, psychology, but it also has to do with politics and society in general. So I think we should hop into it. What do you think?
Sounds perfect.
So what is code switching? You might be wondering, because I honestly had no idea until Jay was like, hey, you should cover code switching on your podcast. And I was like, yeah, totally. What is code switching?
It's like when a telephone operator goes boop, bloop, 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 and answers your call.
So, John, what's code switching?
That's it. I just told you.
Oh.
Code switching is when you switch between languages. Like, if I were to say, hey, Nick, I like your shirt. It looks like a marinara meatball.
Okay, yeah.
I switched into my Italian culture there. That's not true. That's not how that works. For you. I think, Jay, you probably have a better definition than my fake one.
So code switching is when someone is switching between a language, their native language, or a native dialect, switching between that and usually in this context, we're talking about standard English, depending on the social situation. So for example, an example that I kind of brought up a little bit was that, like, being from Detroit originally, so the way I grew up, my parents knew how to code switch. I didn't know what it was when I was a kid, but they had their family and friends voice, and they had their business voice.
Yeah.
And so that's like an example of that. So, like, they would have their say, like their Black American dialect.
Yeah.
When, say, talking with me or talking with our family members, or if they're calling their friends on the phone, versus so my dad had a business. And like if he was talking to someone professionally, then if he got on the phone, like he would speak in what we might call American Standard English.
Yeah. I think about it all the time. And I work at a call center. We talk about it all the time there because everyone has their phone voice.
Yeah.
They just kind of like anytime they call someone, they got a customer on the line, their voice goes up like an entire octave and they're much more articulated and formal. And then they get off the phone and immediately they're like, oh, that customer.
Yeah.
Can you believe that? That's like on the low end of the spectrum, but you're right. Once you take a step up, the conversations kind of around code switching began with mostly bilingual speakers or people that spoke multiple languages.
But it extends the culture, it sounds like, too.
Yeah. Yeah, so like I'll go into the history a little bit here, if you guys will indulge me. It's the whole conversation of code switching kind of started. I mean, it's undoubtedly been around since the dawn of language for the reasons that Jay explained. That people just have different dialects or different comfort levels on what they're discussing. But it wasn't until like the 30s or 40s when people started to actually study it. Jules Ranjat studied it in 1913, yeah, and Werner Leopold studied it in 1939. So it was at the turn of the century, people were already talking about it, but the term wasn't actually coined until 1954 by either Hans Voigt or Einar Hugin. I'm hoping I'm saying that right. Hans Voigt was the one that I saw. He wrote a review for a book called Sprachen in Contact or Languages in Contact by Uriel Weinreich. And apparently he was borrowing from other people, so it could have been either one of these people here. But in the early day, it was an observation of people speaking multiple languages. So they would say they'd immigrate to America, where English is the national language or the primary language, whatever you want to call it. And they came from, I don't know, Germany, something like that. So in their homes, they might speak a mix of German and English. And that's kind of where the idea of code switching came from initially.
It probably even amplified over the next generation, the first generation that was born here.
Oh, absolutely. That comes up a lot when we get into some of like the arguments for and against code switching, why this is important to talk about. But in the late 60s, Jan Peter Blom and John J. Gupertz coined the term metaphorical code switching, which is kind of more what we were talking about when it comes to switching formalities or dialects. Where
when I came here, I learned what supper was.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. Well, so the kind of the example they give is at school, you might speak more proper, more in a more sophisticated way. But at home, you'd speak more casually. You wouldn't be so worried about enunciating your words or saying the right words or whatever. So at school, if you were to start talking about home, you might slip into talking a little bit more casually without even realizing it. Or at home, if you start talking about school, you might slip into a more sophisticated mode of speaking. So that's kind of where these two worlds of code switching collide. And it's not just about bilingual speakers. It's also about the same language slipping in between different dialects or formalities. And that came up right around the late 70s and around the civil rights movement. In 1977, there were parents in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I don't know how close that is to you, Jay.
Well, it's not very close to me now, but it's about 50 minutes away from where I grew up.
Well, that's not too far.
Yeah, I live in Ohio now, so.
Oh, gotcha. But there was parents who sued the Martin Luther King Jr. Elementary School for not teaching their children standard English. And apparently at home, they were being raised speaking what has been coined the African-American vernacular English, there's different variations of what it's called, or AAVE for short. And they thought if their children weren't taught quote unquote standard English, they wouldn't be functionally literate, as the parents put it. And there's also a resurgence in the 90s when more Spanish speakers came to the U.S. So we had more bilingual speakers, like you were saying, John. And now I would argue, I think I've already said this, that code switching and metaphorical code switching are basically the same thing. So that's why it's very hard to define what code switching is. there's a lot of things I've thought about over the last couple of days where I'm like, is that code switching? And even you, John, before we...
Yeah, so I have more questions than answers after
research. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think like what I got out of it, like when I did my research, was that a lot of time, like it's tied in a lot with culture. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, of course, like we all, I think most of us will speak differently, say, like being at work versus being at home or hanging out with our buddies. Yeah. But then I think with code switching specifically, like it tends to be when you talk about somebody's native dialect or native language, it is tied into their culture. So it's a way for them to, for people who are part of those cultures to feel like they can communicate within those cultures, and it's a way of showing that you belong.
And kind of what we'll get into in a little bit is I think that in today's society, people expect people to code switch. And personally, I don't think that's fair for reasons that we're going to get into.
Yeah, there's also the uncomfortability factor of like trying to appease the standard English people. That, like, or trying to change cultures or be uncomfortable. Because,
right. It's kind of like... I don't know. It's.
I'm sure we'll dive into that nice and deep.
There's different levels of it, and I think that by expecting people to code switch, you are judging someone based on how they are speaking rather than what they're saying. And people give it all kinds of derogatory terms, like country. They speak like a country boy. Or ghetto. I've heard that before. Or even posh or snooty or something like that. They all assign these labels that then incur some sort of judgment to it. But some people might be wondering, is there a scientific reason why we code switch? Not really.
That was the shortest I had to wait for that answer.
I've got some reasons why people might code switch. Some people think that it might be the way that someone speaks is inferior or superior, and that's when it gets slippery. But the reasons why we code switch, I got a couple ideas here from NPR, but no really science to it. For the most part, we might not even realize that we're doing it. Like we've said countless times, it's just like, hey, I'm hanging out with these people, and this is how we communicate to each other. And then you go home and you start talking like you talk to your family, and you don't even realize that you're code switching, but you do. The other reason is that you might want to fit in, or Jay, like you said, this brings with it a sense of belonging, something like that. I always think this is more metaphorical, but when I hang out with my high school friends and we haven't seen each other for like 2 years, I always slip back into like the way that we talked in high school, which is much different than the way I talk now. We've been separated for so long, but it's just, it's our way of fitting together still
after so many years.
You know
what I noticed too? I guess my like... One of the most real world examples that I could think of that I've experienced this was I have a barber named Zach.
Yeah.
Go see Zach Mann.
Yeah.
5 Seasons.
Okay.
But anyway, he works there. When you go in, every time you see a guy walk in, they start puffing up their chest and like, what's up, bro? Yeah, I'm just getting here. I'm here for a cut. Yeah. Like, there's like, oh, there's a bunch of like really cool dudes in here. Yeah. I better act all manly.
Yeah, I got to fit in. Yeah.
What my idea
Absolutely.
Of that is.
So. I think that this is when it starts.
We just laugh at them all as they walk through the door.
This is when it starts to get a little... Actually, before I get there, there's one more that's kind of benign, which is that it helps us convey a thought. This is specifically, I think, in bilingual speakers, and obviously not just them, but they might slip into another language because they can't quickly think of the word in the language that they're speaking, but they can think of it in the other language, so that word just comes out and they start mixing these languages together. When it starts to get a little bit slippery is when maybe you want to get something. So I saw my mind immediately went to like Beto O'Rourke during the debates.
Oh no.
Where he just like spoke only in Spanish because he wanted to appeal to Spanish speaking voters. Or you might want to say something in secret. I can't speak Spanish, so I don't know what he said. Maybe it was like, Nick Wood is the worst person on the earth. I don't know.
I saw on Reddit recently, there was a thread that talked about, it asked for people who were in situations where there were a group of people that were talking about them in another language, but they didn't realize that that person also understood them in that language. And so it was interesting reading these awkward situations. Like there's one where there were these people that were speaking in Italian on a bus somewhere. And this other lady who was like an elderly lady turned around and cursed them out in Italian. And they were just really surprised because they didn't expect this woman that was just sitting on this random bus in the U.S. to to understand what they were saying.
Right.
I fantasize about being able to do that.
All of those stories, I've read a couple of those stories, similar stories, and they always just make me cringe because I'm like, what would you do in that scenario?
Yeah.
When you know that someone's like trash talking you and they don't think that you know, that's got to be so uncomfortable. I don't think I'd say anything. I would just turn into a turtle in my seat and just pretend I'm not there anymore.
Yeah, there's this whole story. It was on, I watched Young Turks a bunch, and they have a podcast called Old School where they don't talk politics. They just like talk about their lives. Mm-hmm. There's this guy named Steve O who helps.
Steve O, not Steve O.
Steve O, yes.
Not the.
Okay.
And he had to go. He went to this, like, I guess it was like a barber, and they would cut his hair, and he was the same nationality as him.
Uh-huh.
But he couldn't tell them because they were talking smack, like, not directly about him, but they were just like saying all this really personal, like, awful stuff. And he had to lie and say he was a different race.
No.
And then he had to live that lie forever.
Oh.
So he was worried about like running into them at like and buying like traditional foods and stuff at the store. Like,
yeah. The last thing I'll say about why we might code switch is I kind of mentioned before, we want to get something out of it. I saw one video from Huffington Post that of people saying that they didn't think Obama would be where he or get where he got as a president of the United States if he wasn't an effective code switcher. And like, I don't know, they kind of joke about it when they brought in, was it Key? No. Yeah. Yeah. Came in when he was his anger translator. Is that what you said he was?
Yeah, Keegan.
But a less ominous one is like...
Well, just real quick on that Obama thing. That's going to tie into the uncomfortability factor.
Because
There was a quote from Joe Biden where he said, oh, yeah, he's really articulate.
Yeah.
And you don't say that about a black dude.
Like, yeah.
It gets really bad. Yeah.
Did you have something to say, Jay?
Oh, no, I was just listening, just cracking up.
Oh.
But, yeah, I mean, I think that the... And the whole he's articulate. I think that can be sort of uncomfortable for black people because it does kind of hint at the code switching aspect.
Yeah.
That, okay, we're able to, or the person who is being spoken about, they're able to have this quote unquote sound white or sound respectable to white America. And that is something that is very uncomfortable. And I think we might get into it a little bit later, but it, like, the whole idea of respectability politics, it's a bit sticky.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So here's the exact quote, because this has a little bit more context. Okay. That's worse than I thought.
Oh, gosh, no.
Not
Joe.
I mean, you got the first mainstream African American who is articulate and bright and clean and a nice looking guy.
Oh,
boy.
My God. That's not okay to say, Joe. Wow. Okay. So I came across people who say code switching is a bad thing because if people go home and they speak in a different dialect or they speak like Spanglish, I don't know if that's the right term, but I saw that used in articles, so I'll say it's okay. the people who criticize it would say that this is going to lead these people to speak quote unquote broken or poor English as they see it, I guess, which would lead to poor habits. So they need to follow the standard or standard English as it is in the United States. On the other hand, though, for bilingual speakers, this is kind of what you were talking about before, John, which is that if they speak a different language at home and they go to school and learn standard English, that's going to help bridge the gap specifically for the first generation and this generation into society there. Like, mm-hmm. I saw this countless times in elementary school. I remember that we had a first generation Hispanic girl join our class, and her parents only spoke Spanish at home. She went to school and learned English. And she would tell stories about how she'd go to the store and help her parents translate back and forth if they couldn't understand something. She was able to bridge that gap for her parents, which I think is a very important thing. But there are plenty of people out there who think that that's not okay.
Yeah. Well, there's actually a really cool example of it, too. With I've been trying to watch really good TV. Mm-hmm. And like, what's the best TV shows ever? And I looked at like a million lists, and Deadwood made all of them.
Yeah.
So I watched Deadwood, and then I watched the movie.
Yeah.
And throughout Deadwood, there's a Chinese character who only knows like three or four English words.
Yeah.
And I can't say them on this podcast.
Well, you just reminded me of Firefly.
Then, but hold on real quick. Then they made a movie about 10 years later, and that came out like this year.
Mm-hmm.
And in the movie, because it takes place in the same town in the future, he has a son. Yeah. And his son, all of a sudden, his son speaks English like perfectly and translates for him to the other characters.
Nice.
It's cool that like they built that into it.
Yeah. You remind me of Firefly, where they switch back and forth between like a couple Chinese phrases every once in a while.
Yeah.
because like it's mainly Chinese culture in that show. But yeah, so I want to talk a little bit about why code switching can become a problem in politics or society. And Jay, I'll kind of let you take the wheel here because you are way more politically smart than me.
I don't know about all of that. It's just something that I really find fascinating.
Yeah. Well, let's dive into it. Where does code switching become a problem?
Okay, so where code switching, I think, becomes sort of an issue is when people are using it in a sense of when it comes off as maybe pandering to certain constituencies. Mm-hmm. So I know you mentioned earlier Beto O'Rourke speaking at the Democratic
debates,
talking about like speaking in Spanish, and Cory Booker also did a little bit of that as well.
And then
Julian Castro, I think he had like one or two sentences in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And so now one thing to keep in mind with the Democratic debates was that it was being shown on Telemundo. And so this was a way to communicate to a known Spanish-speaking audience. Mm-hmm. There's kind of a pro and con to this. But on one hand, people can look at this like, oh, well, they're trying to connect or show that they really care about this constituency. Mm-hmm. Which would be, Spanish-speaking immigrants or the descendants of immigrants who might speak Spanish, or they might speak Spanish as one of their languages.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, others would call it what is termed in the media Hispandering.
No.
go ahead.
I did make a Hispandering meme about Beto O'Rourke. So do you know the meme of Steve Buscemi where he says, "How do you do, fellow kids?"
Yeah.
I put Beto's face on it and I put, "¿Cómo lo haces, compañeros niños?"
You put that on our Facebook page, right?
I don't think so.
Oh, I'll post it. You put on something. It's really good.
But yeah, I mean, like Hispandering, like that is this idea of like pandering to these Latino communities without genuinely wanting to focus on issues that specifically affect them.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So there is that. And then sometimes you also see it in terms of not only when it comes to Spanish speaking immigrants, but also when it comes to like other people of color, for example, within the Black community. Mm-hmm. There was actually something that happened sort of recently with Congressional Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Okay.
Or AOC.
Yeah.
So she was speaking with some Black constituents, and she was speaking differently than the way that she would, say, speak on TV or Capitol Hill. So she was, like, speaking in sort of an AAVE or, like, an Ebonics type of speech.
Interesting.
And, yeah, and now, of course, like, in the media, especially on the right,
media
a lot
loves
of...
her.
Oh, well, it depends on which media, but like a lot of like the conservative media, they were saying that she was pandering because of the fact that she's Puerto Rican and she normally doesn't speak like this, but then when she's speaking to this group, she's speaking differently. Mm-hmm. Now, what she said was that because she grew up in a multicultural environment in the Bronx and she was used to that also with being a bartender before she became a Congress rep.
Yeah.
She had receipts, she had evidence that she did speak that way before. So this wasn't some new accent or new dialect that she was pulling.
Like she wasn't trying to pander to an audience.
And I don't think that anyone at Fox and Friends has ever even like,
yeah,
quesadilla, you know?
Like, luckily, they never pander to their audience.
Yeah.
Thank goodness.
And, so I mean, you have that, and then you have, earlier than that, like there's been other examples like Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. And so you hear about that, and you tend to hear about more from Democrats than Republicans, but it doesn't mean that Republicans don't do it. Like George W. Bush spoke in Spanish when he was campaigning, like during both of his campaigns in 2000 and 2004. And then Mitt Romney in 2012 sent out his son, Craig, who speaks both Spanish and English, to stump for him in Spanish-speaking communities.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. It's my argument that it happens more with Democrats because there's more multiculturalism, because
they care about
Republicans
people.
Need more white votes.
That's true. But you reminded me, Jay, of the Trump ad that he put out where he was speaking. What's the language? Man, what was he speaking? Now I can't think of it.
Who? What?
Trump. When he was – all I remember is he said, Abiki Bar Trump Sarkar or whatever. I can't remember what language he was speaking, though.
Arabic?
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. But it just reminded me of that when he was like trying to get – man, I can't remember who it was directed at. I can't remember enough about this ad to talk about it.
I don't remember seeing this at all.
I'll have to send it to you, Jay.
Okay, that'd be funny. Like, I'd love to see it.
Oh, it was Hindi.
Oh, Hindi. Okay, thank you.
Interesting.
He was doing a campaign ad to get, like, Indian support.
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah, it was, I mean, that's a kind of code switching. I don't know if this is more maybe metaphorical, but I feel like when Trump appeals to his base by maybe slipping a couple curse words into his speeches
he's a master of never code switching.
Well, that's maybe true. Well, he code switches when someone writes a speech for him, right? That's like standard English.
I would argue that's just reading.
Maybe. Maybe you're right.
I mean, I think that, like, with Trump, I think he knows how to speak to the people that he wants to speak to.
Yeah.
So it's just that I don't know if we would necessarily call it code switching, but I think that there can be some parallels. One example that I was thinking of was when he kind of had his 2 Corinthians screw up when he was courting white evangelicals while he was having his campaign. But the idea was that he was trying to speak sort of the language of his evangelical base.
Right.
And, I mean, even though it's technically not really code switching per se, but, I mean, I think different communities, even communities like religious communities, have their own vernacular.
Right, exactly.
And so he was at least trying to speak in their vernacular.
And he failed. Did you hear about that, John?
I don't know. I
know you don't know much about religion.
Yeah.
But yeah, like it's pretty much like, so in the Bible, there's a book of the Bible called, well, there's 1st and 2nd Corinthians, so they're 2 separate books. But no one calls it 2 Corinthians. But if you actually just look at the Bible, it just says, it'll say 2 Corinthians. But you know,
people
but most
know the Bible. We'll call it.
Yeah, but people who go to church and all that know it as 2 Corinthians.
Yeah, there's no way Trump goes to church.
So yeah, I mean, it just made it obvious that he just opened up the Bible and saw like, oh, 2 Corinthians,
exactly.
Sure. But
exactly.
But he was making the effort to try to speak in their language.
Yeah.
That's why I think he's a master at it, because he fails every time. He's a master at never code switching.
Oh, he can't code switch. So that,
yeah, he's incapable.
Okay. I'm on board with you.
His code is errors, dude.
Yeah.
He's got 404s.
One other area where I think code switching becomes a problem, I kind of feel uncomfortable saying that, but I think it's the only way to phrase it, is when people expect people to code switch and they don't. And this kind of goes back to the critics that I mentioned before, where I'll give a couple examples that I came across, and I think you guys might have a couple more, where, for example, George Zimmerman, he's the guy that shot Trayvon Martin. He was put on trial. And there was a woman who went to the stand as a witness, Rachel Gentel. She didn't code switch she went on the stand, talked how she talks, and the news just like dragged her through the mud. Specifically like Fox News, someone on there was like, she's ignorant. Every time she opens her mouth, she loses credibility by the second. These are the things that they said about her just because the way she talked and not what she was saying. And in the end, George Zimmerman got off. He never went to jail.
Yeah.
That's horrible. People weren't listening to what she was saying. They were listening to how she was saying it.
And it's like there's an expectation for her to assimilate and to like,
yes,
it sucks.
Yeah. That's a huge problem.
And I think that that's one of the criticisms of the expectation to code switch.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and especially see this when it's a dialect type of code switch. So, for example, in that case, from, you know, African-American vernacular English to American Standard English.
Right.
There's this idea that American Standard English is the is correct English. Mm-hmm. And that means that if you don't, like, if you don't speak that way, or if you don't code switch, then you're going to come off as ignorant, or you're going to come off as uneducated. And so it's going to be harder to be taken seriously. It's going to be harder to achieve economic or social mobility. Mm-hmm. It's harder in a lot of contexts. One of the things that I thought was interesting when I was researching this is I came across an article that was centered around education.
Yeah.
And so there are these researchers, Wheeler, Cartwright, and Swartz, that made the argument that native dialects should be taken into account when assessing the proficiency of children speaking and understanding English.
Yeah.
So their focus. So this came out in 2012, and this was in the journal Reading Teacher, and they focused on biases in standardized testing, in reading, in English, and also looked at the mindset and effects of English teachers, specifically white teachers in mostly black schools, how they affected their students. Mm-hmm. And what they found was that when dialect is not taken into account, because the thing is, even with dialect, with there being different dialects, these dialects do have their own rules.
Yeah.
And like, it's not just like, oh, you're just speaking like whatever. They do have their rules and their syntax and all that. And so when dialect is not taken into account, students are more often assessed below grade level, and they're placed into these developmental or remedial tracks, and then their needs are not properly addressed.
Yeah, they're being treated for not speaking standard English when they understand language perfectly fine.
My gut instinct is that the onus is on the wrong party, because there's so much power in society to expect people to speak standard American English.
Yeah, it's not fair, like, at all.
Yeah.
There's nothing fair about it. That's why this is so interesting and frustrating to a certain degree. Go ahead, Jay.
Oh, the other thing I was going to say too is that it's one of those things that can be internalized within those communities as well. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, for example, the way that I grew up, my parents being, like, they were black, but they're black and they are also well educated. Mm-hmm. And so they taught me, like, oh, well, we want you to speak proper English, meaning American Standard English. Mm-hmm. And they drilled that in to the point that it took me until, like, maybe around high school or so to really be able to make a lot of friends, because like, I had been used to speaking American Standard English at home, mm-hmm. as well as at school or wherever, because they would always correct me.
Yeah.
And so, so I was looked at kind of suspiciously by other students, like, oh, she's not one of us. And, oh, she thinks she's better than us and this, this, and this.
Yeah.
And it was like, it was frustrating. And I think now later on, I was able to kind of learn how to code switch the other way.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, I also had to, over time, unlearn those Eurocentric biases.
Yeah. It's just, it's so bizarre. I don't think that anyone even realizes that they're doing it. Like, anybody from the outside that maybe judged you and said she thinks they're better than us, I'm sure that they weren't thinking about it and
also
not recognizing it.
Like,
kids are
mean.
They'll find an excuse to be mean. But it's like, I don't know, it kind of what we were talking about before. It's the opposite of how, like, Americans perceive a British accent as being smart and credible.
Yeah.
It's like the opposite of that, where for whatever reason, we just cast these judgments on non-standard English. It's ridiculous.
We talked about this in maybe in our language episode.
Yeah, a couple weeks ago.
And before that, too, we talked about our opinion on pronunciation.
Yeah.
And how if you're getting the message across, who cares?
Yeah. That I used to want to be a grammar Nazi, but I wasn't very good at grammar.
Yeah. I want you to talk about this again.
Yeah. Like, I used to be like, you are not speaking proper English. Like, you need to speak the way that the textbook says. But now, if I understand what you're saying, language is a means of communicating information. And if I know what you're saying, then we are perfectly good.
Yeah. Yes,
no problem.
Yes, my mom exactly grabs from her night table drawer, and she'll open the drawer up.
Yeah.
And then I moved here and there was a drawer.
Yeah.
So.
And I say, "What do you want for supper, John?" And you're like, "Oh, what? Dinner? Okay. What do you want for dinner?" Same thing.
Yeah. Oh, supper. That's so funny. Like, I had never. I only heard that on TV.
Really?
I only heard that on TV until I went to college.
Oh.
And my first year, she was from somewhere like in the middle of Ohio.
Yeah.
And she said supper. And I was just like, people say that in real life?
Yeah, I thought it was fake too. I can't convey. Like, it's like an ongoing joke between us, but it's also a real thing that, like, no one has ever said supper in New York.
For it. Yeah. It's just, different.
And then we find out that the language evolved, that they used to be two different meals.
Yeah, it's true.
Anyway, now I'm hungry.
Yeah, no. Coming through my notes here.
So, okay, we talked a little bit about the ways that it could go bad with Jay. Jay, we talked about politics with it too.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I mean, I think maybe going back to that a little bit, I think that it's one of those things that it can go either way. Mm-hmm. It just depends on, it depends on the politician and it depends on the group. Mm-hmm. And I think there is always that question of, like, okay, so is the issue with politicians code switching that if, say, the code switching happens while they're politicking or campaigning, especially by those who weren't raised with that dialect or language? Is it a genuine way to connect with constituents from different cultures, or is it manipulation or pandering?
Yeah.
I guess the way I fall on that is I can't really answer that. I think it's a hard question to answer because I think it really depends. But I also think that in those situations, I think we need to try as much as we can to defer to the people who are part of those groups that are being targeted.
Yeah.
So listen to immigrants and their descendants and listen to people of color. And I think that because I think that people know on some level if somebody is just pandering to them versus if they're serious.
Yeah, if they actually care or not. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that if we listen to people and, you know, not just like say, just tell somebody like, oh, yeah, they're pandering, and it's like without knowing the dynamics, then I think that can start getting into paternalism and that kind of thing. And I think that can be really sticky. So yeah. I think that it's something that I kind of, for myself, I kind of like kind of stepping away from that, especially if I'm not in that group.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It turns into sociology really quick.
Yeah.
Because you have to figure out, like, how am I going to make Fox and Friends uncomfortable and include this community and culture? But that culture is made up of individuals. So it's like you can't make everyone happy. You got to. Right. That's why it's easier on an individual level to hang out with a group of friends versus why politics is such a unique thing is it's on a major stage. And it's like there are so many media groups that you're going to have to like they make that decision if you're pandering or not for you based
that's,
on.
That's the horrible thing of it all. Right. Is that kind of going back to what Jay said is it's really easy for me on the outside to give Beto grief for what I perceive as pandering. But I don't know. Maybe. The Spanish-speaking constituents find that message to be impactful and meaningful to them. And I think it comes down to we need to listen to the substance of what they're saying, not how they're saying it.
And then that's
so just to step back and criticize myself, I'm now teaching myself that message.
I think it's something we can all learn because, I mean, I think a lot of times we can kind of be cynical.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, I think it also depends, too, on, and I think probably the best way of knowing if it's genuine is, okay, what have they done?
Yeah, Beto, guy, you got 30 seconds to talk. You're going to say every sentence in English and then Spanish? Like, we're on a time limit.
Yeah.
it's another complication you add in there.
Yeah, there's no gray area. I think that's what...
I didn't mean to interrupt you, though.
Yeah, you did. What are you, John Delaney? Let's just keep centering it around the Democratic debate. No, I think it's incredibly important to identify, because it is very slippery. There is a lot of gray area. It's not black and white. Context is important, I think, is kind of one of the main points that I got from Jay. And listen to what people say. Not how they say. That's all I had to say. Do you have any other points, Jay, before we take a quick break?
No, that's it.
Awesome. Well, let's take a quick break.
Grab some supper.
Grab some supper. And we'll be right back. John,
yeah,
I don't care about you.
Oh,
I care about Jay and where we can find Jay's podcast.
Alrighty. So you can find Potstirrer Podcast on, well, let's see here. So you can find it. I do have a website, potstirrerpodcast.com. Mm-hmm. It's also on the Flying Machine Network website as well.
Perfect.
Flyingmachine.network.
Yep. And just to give another quick synopsis, how would you describe your podcast to our audience?
I would describe it as politics, religion, and history. Bring it all together, and there you go.
And you stir it in a pot, a big old pot stir.
Mm-hmm.
Pot stir podcast.
He's doing it with his hand.
I'm doing the motion.
It's beautiful. It's like a 24 circumference pot. Like, you kept in the, that was very good mime work.
Thank you. I went to like acting camp in elementary school, and I worked on them a really long time. One thing I like to ask our network friends is, if you were to have a few new people interested in listening, where would you tell them to hop on? Like, what's a really good jumping on point or a really good episode?
I would say, I would probably say there are probably, I would say, Onward Christian Soldiers, which is episode 39.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a good mixture of political pieces. So it's talking about voting and talking about white evangelicalism and white supremacy. And there's a lot of themes in that episode that I talk about in other episodes. So that's probably the best episode to get a good taste of what my podcast is about.
Perfect. So it lays kind of the foundation for a lot of the other stuff. And there's a lot of great stuff on here. Like you said, talked about R. Kelly. That's a topic that never ceases to fascinate me for some reason. I'm so enamored by R. Kelly. Have you seen that video where he's like trying to recruit people in Ethiopia?
Oh my God, yeah.
Oh man.
I mean, you've talked a lot about Christianity and that's somewhere that I came from. I'm not religious now, but I've never thought of it tying into politics and history and all that stuff. So it all comes together very nicely. And it's, like I said before, an immaculately produced podcast. And I think our listeners will enjoy it. So go check it out.
It's the perfect sister show for strangers still.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, if we debunk weird science stuff and all that stuff, Jay debunks politicians and religious figures, and not even just religious figures, just like religions in general. Mm-hmm. And while you're checking out her podcast, if you want to go to flyingmachine.network, we have a lot of stuff going on there this month. We're trying to get some more Patreon supporters, and I kind of danced around it last week. I'm going to go straight for it, guys. So
yes.
We are $3 away from our second goal, which is if we get $160 a month on our Patreon page, we'll have an extra content channel episode every month. So two Flying Machine content channel episodes every month, which is awesome. If you haven't listened to those episodes, those are also immaculately produced. John does some sound work on it.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about Malcolm and Justin talk about all kinds of stuff on there. And to help us get to that goal, there are three different reward tiers now. So for just $1 a month, John,
yeah,
and Jay,
I've got that.
You can get a personal thank you from the host of your show of choice. So if you like our podcast, you give us $1 a month, we will give you a shout out on our show. Done that a couple times before. You also get a bi-monthly newsletter, which I believe is bi-monthly is twice a month. I always get those confused. What's every other month then?
Bi-monthly.
Yeah, it's kind of confusing. I always get that, like, bi-weekly, bi-monthly.
I know, but it is twice a month. And it comes with cultural recommendations from hosts on the network. So I've recommended a lot of stuff like Spider-Man comics, mostly some cartoons like Loud House and stuff like that. And you get access to the Classic Comrade Radio podcast collection, which is 25 hours of the older network episodes, which they had kind of a similar format. My favorite one is the Campfire Stories episode, where everyone wrote like a scary story. That was definitely my favorite. For $5, you get all that stuff. And then you also get access to the APOC radio podcast collection, which is 30 hours of Malcolm and Justin's old, it's
post-apocalyptic.
Yeah, it's a post-apocalyptic themed movie review podcast, which isn't what it sounds like. It is a movie review podcast set in the apocalypse. So they don't review apocalypse movies. They review movies after the apocalypse had happened. It's really funny. It's like you also get access to an exclusive podcast called MCU University.
It's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Malcolm and Justin talking about the movies from the MCU universe. That's the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And there is another show coming out shortly. I don't know if I'm allowed to say it, so I won't. Just stay tuned. And then you get a bonus episode from every podcast on the network. Right now, there are 30. Sorry, that's a lot less than what it is. There are 78 bonus episodes across all of the shows on the network. It's been going on for more than a year. There's a lot to catch up on. And then we just introduced the $10 tier, which is very exciting. You get all the stuff that I mentioned before. I know, right?
And?
So you get all the stuff, and then you also get access to exclusive polls that decide blog and podcast topics, and you also get an annual gift box from the Flying Machine. You get a box full of curated stuff.
Yeah.
It's going to be amazing. So go over to patreon.com/flyingmachine or flyingmachine.network/support to learn all about it and kick a few bucks our way and listen to the bonus episodes where John and I just kind of
say swear words
We say swear words. We BS about previous topics that we've talked about. Jay, what are your bonus episodes like, just for our audience?
They're typically deep dives into different topics, or I probably censor a lot less. So
that's the best thing about the bonus episodes.
Yeah, that's the thing. You'll hear me more unfiltered. So so yeah, that's definitely worth it.
There's definitely a direct, like, definitionally code switching between both of our regular podcasts and our bonus episodes.
Yeah.
So definitely check that out.
That's the premium you pay for an uncensored host of your favorite podcasts. So I don't have anything else. I think that'll cover it for this week. Make sure you check out the Potstir podcast. And I guess I'll just say I'm still Nick.
I'm still John.
And I'm Jay.
And this is Stranger Still.
I give you the incredible flying machine.